And so the story goes, the pilot, who was Australian, anchored this thing off in a lake in New Providence Island, which is Nassau, and decided to take off with the anchor down. He figured if I pulled the anchor, the thing would drift on the shore and get all stuck. So he tried to take it off with the anchor dragging, and pulled a nose down, flipped it upside down, and there it lay on the bottom of the lake when I found it in the early 90s. Myself and another guy got interested. I'd been flying seaplanes for a long time, and I wanted a duck, couldn't find one, so I started collecting parts, and I started talking to everybody I knew about duck parts. And one of those guys was Dean Franklin, who was an amphib guy in Miami who had been in this business forever. And he says, hey, why don't you just go get that one over in the lake in the Bahamas? So I said, okay. So I went over and asked around, and I said, gee, let's go fly and show me the wrecks. Well, it turns out there's wrecks all over the place. That doesn't narrow the field much. And when I'm flying with this guy, he says, oh, yeah, and there's an old wrecked seaplane over in this lake. Of course, I got all excited and said, well, let's go take a look. And we overflew the wreck site. You couldn't tell it was an airplane, but you could see a little dark dot in the lake. So I got some coordinates and decided, hey, that's what I'll do. I went back to town, bought a kiddie raft, and rented some scuba equipment, and threw all the scuba equipment in the kiddie raft and paddled out in the middle. And sure enough, there was laying on the bottom, prop, engine, wings, tail feathers, the whole works, upside down. So I went down with a wire brush, scrubbed it a little bit, see if it was worth saving, and decided, yes, it was. Went to the Bahamian government and in essence said, hey, I want that airplane. And they said, good, there's one less wreck on the island. And I went home and put my gear together in three duffel bags. Never forget it. Three duffel bags, lift bags, all the accessory tools, come-alongs, everything you'd need for a limited recovery. And went down to the airport, checked in, and one of the first duffel bag was over 100 pounds. And I remember the guy at the counter said, as he groaned, he says, oh, good job. And I'm sure they'd jail you for that kind of thing today. But anyway, shuffled the stuff around the bags, got down to the Bahamas, and my friend and myself went down and began to disassemble it. Turns out that things are easier to disassemble underwater in a certain way. Water's a lubricant, so you don't have to mess with all the rust. You just sit there and wrench on it. The tough part is you're weightless underwater, and your body tends to turn instead of the nut. But we persevered, took about a week and a half to disassemble this thing and bag it up. And it was laying on the top wing, so we took the two bottom wings first, brought them in, and for some reason I wanted to get the main wing, top wing, next. So we lifted the airframe off of it and set it back down on the bottom, and I should have just drug it in at that point, but I didn't. So we took the main wing, drug it in, and rebagged the fuselage, only I rolled it right side up on the bottom and then brought it up engine high. You can see a picture here where the engine and the prop are breaking water, and I'm telling you, about 10 seconds after that picture was taken, that airframe rolled 180 and went back down to the bottom faster than the Titanic. So the bags were all torn up, and we were all just demoralized, and it wasn't like we had a big crew. There was two of us out there with our hair on fire. And so next day, we went out, and then this time I thought, you know, I'm just going to bag this thing up any way I can get it. And that was upside down, and we did lift it up, drug it into shore. And as you get near the shore, it gets shallower. And I had a mobile crane standing by to hook onto it, but you couldn't get it because it wasn't close enough. Finally got near the shore, and I thought, well, I'm going to pull it in just a little closer. And the prop blades hit the shore. The whole prop power section and exhaust just fell off on the bottom of the lake, just ahead of the accessory case. So I said, okay. We brought the fuselage in, put it on a flatbed trailer, went back, retrieved the engine, pulled that out, hauled it to a yard, and I put it on a big pallet shipped it into Miami as deck cargo on a freighter. I had one of my guys down there with a pickup trailer. We offloaded it off of the freighter right onto the trailer and headed back to Seattle, and just happy as a clam. Subsequent to that, I just started collecting parts. I found there were a couple of issues about this airplane that you should know. One, I thought 1820 engines were everywhere. They built thousands of them. So the engine was on a B-17. What I didn't know is the early generation direct drive 40 spline 1820s were about 600 to 800 horse. And the 1820-30 was specifically built for this airplane. They built 125-30 engines. And I didn't realize that at the time. I might have given up because it was so rare. But I never thought anything about it. And I'm going through the Seattle Museum one day, and I look at it and say, gee, there's a little direct drive engine. Wonder what it is. And it happened to be a Dash 30. And ended up trading the museum for a rebuilt 1820 to fit their B-17 bomber. And they were happy, and I was happy, and that's how I got the engine for it. The other big collection issue were the instruments. All of them are just antique, and it just took a lot of hunting to find all the instruments. This doesn't even have an electric fuel gauge in it. They were operated by air. And when I first started going after the stuff, the instrument guy said, there is no such thing. And so that was tough, and I started building it, and it's a big, big job. And pretty soon it occurred to me that I really wanted to see it fly, and I didn't have enough horsepower to do it. So I had to give way, and that's how it went to Chuck. Okay, I guess we'll talk about the restoration portion. The restoration was done by Wichita Air Service. Derek Johnson is here today, and he was with that restoration all the way through.
Yeah, Derek, would you tell us about the restoration?
Yeah, I can do that.
Thank you, Bill. That was great, yeah.
One of the first things everybody notices is the pile of parts here, and that's what 90% of it looks like when it comes into the shop. The first thing everybody says is, where are you going to start? And we have a saying at the shop that doing this kind of stuff is like eating an elephant. You just have to start somewhere, pick one part, and work your way through. That's all you can do. Everybody asks me, you know, how much of it's original. A good guess there is about 70%. We do have to procure parts and find... For instance, the forward section of the hull was bought. There was still quite a bit of work that needed to be done in there. Obviously, it wasn't bought from Grumman new. It was one, I think, came out of Alaska. Is that right, Bill? Yeah. So. Or out of Kentucky. Okay. Yeah, and it needed... extensive repairs to it. A lot of the formers in the lower half were corroded through, along with some hatchet disassembly that was done. A lot of the parts in the airplane, Mr. Greenhill himself built and fabricated, helped us out quite a bit on a lot of the parts. We did the wings are... I don't know, 60% probably. They were they're a aluminum wood wing, essentially. They're built just like the wooden rib in a wing, except it's aluminum. You can see when you've got it apart the transition between wood to aluminum, and it's right there in that area. You know, it's not a stamped wing rib. The paint scheme, as Bill mentioned, is as it was prior to the attack, December 7th, 41. There's extensive research that went into that, the exact colors, the squadron insignia, the engine itself, as they mentioned, is one of 32 ever built. I have a lot of people tell me, you know, oh, there's several of these ducks around. They're all... You know, they're all the same, and they're not. This is the Grumman-built example, and the only Grumman-built example that we know that survives today. The Dash 6s were built by Columbia Aircraft under license by Grumman. So there's several changes, the biggest one being the engine and the horsepower rating. And we can go into detail on that with questions if anybody wants to ask. But everything in the aircraft, down to every rivet, every screw, is the exact original hardware that was used. There are rivets in this aircraft that Mr. Greenhill put on a lathe and cut to the right specifications. We went through several sources, a lot of old warehouses, things like that, found hardware that were on the shelf, took them in, having replated and put the airplane together. The depth of the restoration that Chuck had us do was painstaking at times, but we are proud to say that it is right and it is authentic. There's not a single Phillips head screw in this airplane. It's all slot head screws, and believe me, that's not cool. it makes it very, very difficult, with the exception of some of the modern avionics that are in it for the safety purposes. But no pull fasteners. Everything is a driven rivet. There are no riv nuts, anything like that. They didn't use them then. So it is, that pretty much cover it.